too fat?
I haven't had a carb since 2004.
Calories.
That's a gluten. Fat. That's a gluten.
Yeah, it's got electrolytes.
Filled protein combined with synthetic aminos, vitamins, and minerals. Everything the body needs.
I'm only eating foods with less than 30% calories from fat. It's 40%.
He read the squirrels were high in cholesterol.
We're about to find out what happens when a policy student and a science student interact.
And I also brought you some hydroponically grown goji berries with vegan barbecue sauce and some organic pumpkin chips.
Short answer, being vegan just makes you better than most people.
I happen to be a vegetarian.
You must have had vegetables fresher than that growing up on a farm, Greg.
Never trust a vegetarian.
Looks like meat back on our menu.
The views and opinions expressed on this show are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of WMFO, Tufts University, or the Friedman School of Nutrition.
Yes. Who's hungry?
And the people did feast upon the lambs and sloths and carp and anchovies and orangutans and breakfast cereals and fruit bats.
Good morning and welcome to an Unbalanced Breakfast here on WMFO 91.5 FM, streaming live on WMFO.org.
Hello.
I'm your host, Matt, and here with me in the studio today is tomorrow's commencement speaker
for the Friedman. Oh, great. I'm glad that you made sure to say that.
Science of Policy graduation.
I did not see this coming.
So congratulations for that, Catherine.
Thank you very much. We'll see how it goes.
You ready for your big moment?
Nope. That's about all I got to say about that.
All right, we'll move right along.
It's
going to
be a big surprise for me how it goes tomorrow.
Yes, it'll be everyone. It's going to be great.
We'll see. I don't want to make any promises.
Yeah, this is a big weekend for you because obviously, for everyone, tomorrow is graduation. Here at the General Tufts campus,
everyone
as well
Tufts.
As all the other little schools, including ours. Catherine will be speaking, and this is your last. At least hosting job on Unbalanced Breakfast.
Yes, this is my last week with Unbalanced Breakfast, so you're all welcome.
Listen, I appreciate you. I appreciate you being here for the past 11, well, not the past 11 weeks, but for
however
10 shows.
However many shows.
10 shows. We've had 11. You've been on 10.
Yeah, okay. Nice.
And
nice.
So if you want to call in and talk to Catherine on her last day here, number here is 617-627-3800.
Yeah.
And you can also reach us on Twitter at Boxman37. It's me. And Catherine is Nutrition Wonk.
Yes.
For now.
Mm-hmm.
So definitely hit us up. It's your last day to do so. And we'll be finally getting to the Biggest Loser today.
Yes, finally.
But otherwise, we don't have a big set plan.
No.
It's the last weekend. I'm going to be reflecting a little bit on Friedman.
Mm-hmm.
You could call it an agenda-free show, if you will.
Well, we've got a couple callers who are graduating from Friedman tomorrow with us, and we just thought it would be nice to do a little bit of a reflection on what were people's experiences going to Friedman? What is it like going to the Friedman School? I know that before I applied, I tried to find like blog posts or people's almost like reviews of the school. Like, this is what it was like to go here. And that's actually kind of hard to find. I'm sure that along with the new strategic plan they're doing, like the Friedman School is really changing its like social media presence and changing its, and the website's changed and everything. So it might be that they do like more of an outreach, like outward facing kind of student testimonials to talk about like, here's what it's like to go here. But I don't think those things really existed, at least when we applied. Mm-hmm. And so
I just picked the name of a school out of the hat.
Fried Man? Sounds good. So we thought it might be a good idea to have like, oh, well, what was your experience like? And so that anybody who's either a prospective student or a first year student can get some tips, I guess, maybe.
Very
for
cool.
What to do, what not to do.
No, that's good, yeah. And
yeah.
People, it's the whole new age of media, as we've been saying, so definitely the whole audio video thing, that's what people are looking for.
Mm-hmm.
So talking about the Friedman experience is definitely a good thing. And we're now up on the student activities page, right?
We're up on the student activities page because now Unbalanced Breakfast is officially a student activity. So hopefully somebody will want to take this over for next year, unless you spin it off, Matt,
I can say right now, there will be an Unbalanced Breakfast next weekend. That does not mean the show is going away. Just stay tuned for scheduling details from here on out, mm-hmm. and co-host details.
And now that I'm not going to be on the show, I'll just be your like official troll.
Yeah, or I'll you could be our official expert. We'll episodes. Be like, we got to call, we're just going to call you blindly. so I hope you answer your phone.
Yeah, you totally should, because I'd be so helpful. You could ask me a question, I'd be like, I don't know the answer to that.
And you'll be
let me Wikipedia it really fast.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, it's radio, so people won't know. Yeah. You can just go. And before we get to The Biggest Loser, we haven't spent a whole ton of time on the fitness aspect of the show.
Yeah.
But this is very exciting. Another big part of the big weekend for you is you did some sporting last night, right?
I sported. So yeah, I went to Fenway last night, and I've been to Fenway before. I've been to two Red Sox games. Well, this will have been my third Red Sox game, which is pretty amazing for me. Okay. And there were sports happening while I was there.
Do you know what sport it was?
It was the baseball sport. And also, so my partner, my life partner's friend from high school actually plays for the Cleveland Indians.
Jason Kipnis, for those Jason of you, Kipnis. Which is a big deal for those of you who have
okay,
followed.
Yeah. So, and I actually didn't get to see him. I've met him once, like at Christmas time, but I didn't get to see him. I came in late, but we went in and we saw batting practice, and then we watched the game, and we saw Jason Kipnis hit like a 3-run home run. So that was really cool and exciting. And I ate a Fenway Frank. So that was probably the highlight of my experience.
What did you think?
I liked him, but I just was in, for someone who doesn't really like sports, I've literally been to two baseball games in a month. So I was just at Wrigley. So their hot dogs are better.
I mean, I'm not going to defend anything about.
Yeah,
Fenway,
I don't want to be the person who's like, Chicago hot dogs are better. But they are, and also both stadiums.
Was it the Chicago dogs with like the pickles and stuff? And
yeah. Mm-hmm. But both stadiums are so great. Like I've been to a few stadiums, and I'm from Pittsburgh, so the PNC Park is like beautiful. The view from PNC is beautiful. But Fenway, yeah, and Wrigley,
I think at one point it's considered the best stadium in the majors.
PNC.
Yes.
It's so gorgeous. It's like looking at a painting. When you're sitting there, but. It's the actual stadium itself. Like, Fenway and Wrigley are both so distinct.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I really enjoy being in both of those places. And so the baseball happened. And I really, really tried to pay attention. And that was basically, like, how it went.
A Red Sox game is not the best game to go to if you're if you're trying to do just that. If you're trying to pay attention keep your attention span for a certain amount of time. A Red Sox game is going to go 3.5 hours minimum, probably. And
yeah, why?
They're notorious for that because it's the Red Sox, and you have people like David Ortiz who need to take their time, 45 seconds. And David Price, who as a Rays fan, I will attest to, he needs his 35 seconds between pitches, which is now supposed to be illegal. But they enforce it for half a season, and now baseball games are too long again.
Oh, okay.
And everyone's mad, and all the veterans get mad because they don't want to be rushed. It's so dumb. Meanwhile, you go to a hockey game, it's over in 2.5 hours max.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's a whole other story, a whole other argument for another day.
I mean, it was a beautiful night. It was great to do before we leave Boston, you know, before graduation and stuff. So it was I had a really fun time. I don't know a lot about sports, although I did find myself like trying to look at, I was looking at like the averages and then all. So I was looking statistics. At all the statistics that was like what was interesting
Friedman,
to me.
There's something about Friedman. You go to statistics, you learn what regression is to figure out how you do normalized statistics, like and regressed FIP and WAR and all that, so you'll get a whole different appreciation.
I mean, I didn't do any of that. I was looking at people's batting averages, but
that was what I was going to say. Unfortunately, you didn't get to see our friend Pablo, who we've discussed on the show, because he's on the disabled list, so he did not play.
Yeah, I had a brief thought of like, who's that guy?
All right, so let's transition now to the topic that you've wanted to discuss for quite a while.
Yes.
That is the Biggest Loser study that came out.
Biggest Loser study, I feel like it came out like 100 weeks ago at this point. 3 or 4 weeks ago. Basically, so what a lot of people don't know about the Biggest Loser is that they've been doing essentially science experiments on the participants of the Biggest Loser for a pretty long time, because you have a group of people who are dealing with morbid obesity, who lose a significant amount of weight in a short period of time, and it's so regimented and so monitored that it just creates this incredible group of people to study. So they've done a bunch of studies on, you know, the predicted metabolic changes, or looking at how their resting metabolic rate changes compared to people who have gastric bypass. So that was a study that came out maybe a year and a half ago, and looking at like their lean tissue preservation Anyway, the newest study, which was, you should read the article in the New York Times. That was the one that broke, kind of broke the study, by Kevin Hall et al. He's from the NIH, NIDDK. And basically, they followed them and they did pre-weight loss, post-weight loss 6 months out, and then 6 years later. So followed them 6 years later to see what kind of changes were there in their... Their primary outcome was looking at their resting metabolic rate. So that is your metabolic rate when you're at rest. I mean, it's literally exactly what it sounds like.
So basically, how many calories you need to maintain your weight.
Yes.
Without exercising.
Right, without exercising. And exercise, too, like when you're... this is a fun fact, and I think I might have mentioned this before, but when you're on an exercise machine and it's telling you how much you're burning, it's telling you how much you're burning to stay alive plus the amount that you're exercising off. So that is why it's not a great idea to add back in the calories that you exercised off if you're tracking calories, because part of that is what you would have been burning anyway, even if you were watching TV. Anyway, segue back. What happens when you lose weight is that as you're losing weight, your metabolism slows down to compensate. But your metabolism slows down disproportionately to the amount of weight that you are losing. So basically, if you start with a pretty big calorie deficit, after a few days, that calorie deficit's going to get smaller, not because you're eating more, but because your body has slowed down your metabolic rate. But the question is, does that normalize over time? And if you lose a significant amount of weight, does your resting or your RMR go back up? And so they followed the Biggest Loser people for 6 years, and they found that in this group of people, which is a very specific group of people, their resting metabolic rate went significantly down and then stayed down even as they gained weight. So basically what that means is that they did predictions and said a person who's never lost weight, this is what this person would be burning at this body weight. And then compared it to that's not literally what they did, but this is what they're talking about.
I mean, and it went down by like an average of almost 500 calories, right? So basically, just to throw a number out there, at that weight that they're at, it should be like, oh yeah, you can eat 2,000 calories and not gain or lose weight. But that would be a normal person who hadn't gone through the Biggest Loser. But after going through it and losing all that weight, suddenly they only need 1,500 calories.
Now, most of them are still a little heavier, so they're probably still eating over 2,000 calories a day to maintain their weight. Although at least one person said she needed to eat, under 2,000 calories a day. I imagine Biggest Loser contestants are pretty good at balancing their calories, like at counting calories. But you never know. They could be off, whatever. But what's really interesting is that it seems like when people do gastric bypass surgery, so that's where part of your stomach is removed or part of your small intestines are removed, so you don't digest food as well and you can't eat as much, that those people's metabolism normalizes much more so than people who were on the Biggest Loser. So the question is, what is it that is helping people who have bypass surgery normalize their metabolisms when they're losing weight over a similar period of time? And so some of the question about that is whether or not circulating appetite hormones are affecting intake. So they did find in the Biggest Loser contestants is that not only were their metabolisms lowered, that they had significantly lowered leptin secretion, which is a hormone that is secreted by your adipose tissue that tells your brain, there's plenty of fat, we've got plenty of stored energy, you don't need to eat so much. So these Biggest Loser contestants had significantly lower leptin than they maybe ought to have. It's hard to make any real assumptions or conclusions based on that because the study wasn't powered to look at the different hormone levels pre and post, but it's definitely something that the researchers noticed and wanted to kind of examine in the future. So now a bunch of things have come out. I think the New York Times article intimated this and a bunch of other articles, just sort of like, well, you shouldn't lose weight because your body's going to fight back against you. And I think that there's been sort of a pushback against that in the media where people are like, well, actually, these people, did they really need to lose this much weight to begin with?
So how is it different from, how is it different from any method of losing weight? Is it unique to these people because it was so quick, or you know,
it's fast, and they also exercise an incredible amount. So interestingly, they preserve more lean mass. So they preserve more of their muscle mass than people who have like a gastric bypass surgery, which is not surprising, right? Because they're exercising. Like, I think when they're on the ranch or whatever, that's the part where they're on TV living in the house, they are exercising like between 3 and 7 hours per day. So I think they're under like an incredible amount of like physical stress.
So it's like a lot of other things if you take it to an extreme.
Right. Yeah. And so it's hard to
not
know.
Be great for you.
Yeah. It's hard to know. Is it specific to this form of weight loss, which is very severe? I mean, they go on extremely calorie restricted diets and then they have to burn a certain number of calories through exercise daily. Or is it something where like we're looking at, you know, it's like a dose response. So we're looking at the most extreme version of it, but every version of it is going to be similar. I don't know if there's an answer to that.
So, okay. So if you were, so who is, what is, what would this be an indictment on? Is it just the weight loss in general? Is it the show for being terrible?
I think the show.
Or is it just, you know, this is what happens if you sign up for this is and lose all this weight, this is what's going to happen. And you just need to deal with it afterwards and have, you know, well, control your calories.
I mean, I think it's an, I think the show is problematic for a lot of different reasons. I don't think that, you know, when the show started, they knew this was going to happen. So I don't think you can really say, oh, it's the show's fault. I think at this point, now that the science has come out, I think that should make people think twice about wanting to be on the show, or whether or not that type of weight loss intervention is a good idea. But you know, I think the people are looking at it as an indictment on weight loss, and I don't think we need to really go that far. I mean, the majority of people, so they all, almost all of them regain weight. Only one person in the study didn't regain weight, which is interesting and is consistent with kind of the statistic that everybody throws around that like 95% of people who go on diets are unsuccessful. But a majority of the people who participated in The Biggest Loser did maintain weight loss of at least 10%, which is essentially what the CDC and like the diabetes association, everything, that's what they recommend for, you know, for metabolic benefit. So if, when people are really overweight and they're dealing with issues like hypertension, high blood glucose, whatever, usually it's recommended that you lose between 5 and 10% of your weight. And so most of them, not a huge majority, but most of them did maintain 10% weight loss. So the question is sort of, how much weight do you really need to be encouraging people to lose? Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not going to claim to know the answer to that, but I think people are trying to look at it and say weight loss is useless. I think that's a little too far,
right? Obviously,
of a leap, but I do think that it was a really interesting study. The study is available for free online. I think it was published in the journal Obesity, so definitely check it out. You know, if you like to read studies. And you can see kind of the comparisons they do with the pre and post hormones. But yeah. And check out the New York Times article.
Yes. So if you want to weigh in on that, no pun intended, or anything else, give us a call at 617-627-3800. We are going to take a song break. This is Catherine's choice for the week. It is Sia, Bird Set Me Free, and you're hearing it on Unbalanced Breakfast on WMFO 91.5 FM, streaming live on WMFO.org.
Clipped wings, I was a broken thing. Had a voice, but I could not sing. You'd want me down. I struggled on the ground. Oh, so lost the line, have been crossed. Had a voice, but I could not talk. You held me down. I struggled to fly now. Oh, but there's a swim inside. Alive. Oh, it is a
Welcome back to an Unbalanced Breakfast on WMFO 91.5 FM, streaming live on WMFO.org. You just heard Birds Set Free by Sia. That was Catherine's choice. Do you want to explain why real quick?
Yes, I love Sia.
There you go.
That's why.
That's reason enough.
That's the whole reason. She's coming to Boston Calling. She's the Friday night.
Boston Calling, which is in hot water. I've always been anti-Boston Calling, and now there's a legit reason to be.
I just want to know what
your Walsh
are
is
pro.
Is in some trouble. What'd you say?
I just want to know what you're pro. Anti-everything.
The song I'm going to play later. That's what I'm pro.
Okay. Yep. All right. That's fair.
All right. And with that, we're going to welcome our first caller of the morning. So, actually, why don't you take it away, Catherine?
Hi, Julia. So, Julia Kelly is our first caller. She is graduating tomorrow from Friedman. Congratulations. She's in the Agriculture, Food, and Environment program. Just realized I'm not sure what those letters stand for, at the Friedman School, and is a registered dietitian as well. So, hello, Julia.
Hello.
Anything else you want to add about yourself?
Oh, no. I think you did a pretty good job.
Do you have any hobbies, any fun skills?
Oh gosh, I don't think I had time for hobbies during grad school, but I am really looking forward to just being able to be home and cook and read and do the things that I let go of when I started 2 years ago.
So can you tell us a little bit about, like, what is the AFE program, and then what made you decide to come to the Friedman School for it, and then maybe reflect on, like, how was your Friedman experience? That's like a huge, I just threw out a huge question. So kind of pick the parts that you want to answer and go for it.
So I did the Agriculture, Food, and Environment program. And it's really just, it's a policy-based program. I kind of like to start with that because it kind of gets confusing. It's a policy-based program where we really study, you know, the food system, particularly the domestic food system, what's going on in America, its production system, and then just a lot of things that relate to it. So I took a couple of different environment classes. Mine were really oriented to climate change in particular. And then you get to take a couple of different introductory classes or just additional classes to create a specialization, what you do. So mine ended up being consumer insights and market management. That was kind of what I was interested in. It's like the marketing side of the food system. And so you really have the chance to kind of tailor this program to what you want to do. But the main emphasis is, like, the agricultural production system. Mm-hmm. And, you know, coming to Friedman, I think it was kind of surprising for some of the faculty why I wanted to do AFE rather than, say, FPAN, because that's what most kind of registered dietitians or people that have that kind of background go into. But I just remember having this kind of epiphany moment during my undergraduate degree. We were in class talking about, you know, fish recommendations and what people should be eating. And then around the same time that was happening, I was kind of seeing on the news that there was, you know, issues with cod and how they were having to put a really strict quota on cod and how much they were going to be pulling out of the fisheries. And it was just kind of that, like, epiphany moment where I realized, you know, is what we're eating really in balance with our production system and what we're producing and what we can produce? And that issue just really kind of stuck with me. And climate change, too, and coming into that and how that's going to affect, you know, what we're eating, the water that we have, and kind of those external sources, because they all interact. This is a food system, so it's kind of a big circle. So I kind of just switched gears when I hit graduate school. I wanted to really learn more about the production system and what was going into the food system that we all eat from. But the last 2 years have been, you know, absolutely amazing. I wouldn't trade it for the world. And I definitely think AFE was a perfect fit for what it was that I wanted to learn about. And, you know, I thought I would come out of it just really sure about things. Like, you'd have, like, all these answers and, you know how to, like, fix the problem. But, you know, I think I came out of it realizing, like, there's so much I don't know. But on the positive side of that, you really kind of understand how to weigh this idea of what you expect to gain, but also thinking about the fact there will always be unintended consequences. And I think that was something that the program was really good about trying to instill, is just thinking about this in a system and how these will interact, how the choices that you make are going to interact with positively and negatively, and understanding, like, the repercussions of any type of policy you put in or a change in the system and the way that you start interacting with it. Or, you know, I really went, like, a business route with things in the program that I did. I plan on going into industry after this, and so you really see, like, how the industry interplays with all of this as well. And so it's it's been a fantastic 2 years. It really taught me a lot.
That's so cool that you say, or it's so interesting that you say, like, I feel like at the end I realize, like, there's so much that I don't know. I feel like I had the exact same experience, and I think it'd be interesting to see if there are any Freedman students who didn't have that exact same experience of coming in and being like, I'm going to find the answers, and then finishing and saying, okay, now I see why I was wrong to think that I was going to find the answers, but you're much more well-equipped to research whatever it is that you're going to look into. But I was just wondering, so as a registered dietitian, would your nutrition advice, or would the advice that you give people who ask you about what to eat change based on what you've learned about agriculture and the environment? What changes would you make?
So, I mean, we typically tell people, stop eating meat and please eat more fish. You know, that's a very common one. Mm-hmm. And that really fits in pretty well with pretty much everything I've learned about the food system is, you know, plants by and large are much better to produce, but you do learn a lot of nuances and arguments. You know, I came in not really sure about GMOs, not really sure what to think of them, didn't really understand them, and I came out of the program equally unsure of GMOs in various ways. But I think my understanding of them and why I'm unsure of them is so much more solidified in the fact that it has different environmental repercussions, it has different repercussions in the body, and while I'm really not concerned about it when it comes to digesting it, I am concerned about them when it comes to their repercussions in the environment and this idea of just gene spread, and we don't really know how they're going to interact, and so it's more of those issues that I find it to be a little bit more important. But I mean, the other thing too is that I learned a lot more about industry. So and this is somewhat unrelated to Freedman. We had a couple of business classes from the school, and I remember in those classes I learned a little bit more about just the soda industry, for example, and how that industry is set up. Mm-hmm. And I remember being like, you know, why can't we just get rid of sugary sodas? You know, it's just one of those things. Like, as a registered dietitian, I didn't learn about this kind of stuff in my undergrad, and it makes sense because we're really focused on, you know, clinical and hospital, at least my program was. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't really understand this, like, industry side of things. And we had a case study in one of my classes where we really just broke down the soda industry, and you just realize how profitable it is and how, you know, it's a fantastic business model. You know, if you're going to business, I can understand why you'd want to do that. Because it's so profitable in the way it's set up, it's so easy. It would be so difficult to get rid of. And so I think just having that kind of understanding has really helped me understand just the difficulties and the nuances of working in this, like, policy sphere. Mm-hmm. Because that's an area where I think we did not get enough understanding of just how that system works to really understand why our food was coming out the way it is and why what's being produced is being made. And that has so much to do with how we eat these days. But I mean, by and large, I mean, really, I hate using the word sustainable. I really despise that word, but sometimes it's just easiest to say, you know, a sustainable diet. I mean, really falls in line with a lot of dietary recommendations. It's just some of those nuances in it with GMOs and things like that. It's a lot stickier to say. Or, like, you know, for organic, for instance, I mean, there's so many positive benefits. And when I think about, you know, pesticides, I don't think about them as much in terms of ingesting it, particularly for adults, because it's, you know, such small amounts, but it's so beneficial for the environment in so many different ways. But the other thing too is, you know, people just simply need to be eating more fruits and vegetables, and if the cost is going to be a deterrent, I would rather you be ingesting more than it would be. So it's just, there's so many different nuances.
Ingesting more fruits and vegetables that aren't organic based on cost versus having to go organic.
Yeah, it's going to be a deterrent, you know, right. Anyway. So it's just one of those things where there's just so much nuance in the discussion. You really have to think, you know, what's the bigger picture? And sometimes it's really hard to take away.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, and I kind of agree with what you said about the AFE program. Being an AFE grad myself, first of all, being able to tailor your specialization basically whatever you want is definitely a cool thing, especially because I know for FPAN, they kind of have some suggested specializations that you're not locked into, but those seem to be a bit more focused, whereas AFE, you basically have free rein. It's like you find any three courses that kind of relate to each other and go with it. And then true what you said about kind of almost having more questions than answers by the end of the 2 years. And I'm wondering, is there anything that you would have changed about the last 2 years, whether it be coursework or activities or anything like that?
Oh gosh, that's a good question. Well, first of all, I would like to say, I mean, stats and econ form the foundations of this program. And mm-hmm. while you know that going into it, you know, you're taking a lot of stats and based on econ, I don't think I realized how much it would integrate into all of the other kind of mean required classes. Like, I don't know. I guess I'm just used to having a little bit more of a silo with that kind of stuff. And so, if somebody had told me that, I would have been like, I'm not doing this program. there's no way. But actually, I'm just so thankful for that work. And I really do wish I had taken more statistical courses.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I took the main ones required, and I really wish I'd taken an additional one. I tried to fit it in, just couldn't. But I highly recommend it to anybody just to keep going on stats, because one, it's so easy to lose it, one, and two, it's so important.
Super interesting.
It's so important for what you do.
Yeah, I think one key factor for anyone listening who's like, oh, maybe I'll go back for nutrition, is like, if your degree isn't mostly stats, you're missing out on a lot of nutrition, because it's not just the economy and it's not just agriculture. I mean, that's how all of the nutrition science is done too. So it's all the fields are
and there's a good chunk of behavioral economics too, so it's not just money and industry and finance.
Right.
All right. So awesome. Was there anything else that you wanted to talk about from anything about your Freedom experience or anything else? And you're not from New England, right? Where are you from originally?
So I actually came from Oklahoma, Tulsa to be exact, and I moved here, a week before classes started, so I got Boston at the most beautiful time, and I went through the worst winter of my life right after. Boston's been a great experience. It's nice to move into a city. I think it confuses people that you're doing, like, an ag program in the city, like, in a major city. Everyone's like, what are you doing? I'm like, very policy-oriented program, so it makes sense. But it's been a fantastic 2 years, and I wouldn't trade it. You learn a lot. You get exposed to a lot. I remember my first maybe like 6 months in the program, I was like, I don't know what I want to do anymore, because like everything was so interesting, and you meet the most interesting people who have such diverse backgrounds. And I think the biggest takeaway from this was just the Freedman community in itself.
Oh yeah, I agree with you. All right. Well, thank you so much for calling in.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, this has been good. Well, congratulations. We'll probably see you tomorrow.
Congratulations.
And good luck whatever comes next.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. See you later.
All right. So there you go. There's our policy call, right? So it probably did a much better job of describing FE than I ever have in the past 3 months.
Now we're going to find out what Matt likes.
Yeah. So this is going to be my song. And I played this... last times I had a last episode of a show, even though this technically isn't the last episode, but this is the Suicide Machines with Goodbye For Now off their self-titled 2000 release. This band does not exist anymore, but
this is what that was.
If you're you're about
not
to hear
that it's
it. This
bad,
the genre, but the band doesn't exist. But if you're interested, the former lead singer is now in a band called Break Anchor, which is a great band. Check them out. But anyway, Suicide Machines, Goodbye For Now. This is Unbalanced Breakfast on WMFO.
The Massachusetts Department of Fire Services encourages you to beat the beep. Carbon monoxide alarms have been required in nearly every residence since March of 2006. Did you know that the life expectancy of these alarms are only 5 to 7 years, depending on the manufacturer? Many detectors installed after the state's carbon monoxide law was passed are now reaching the end of their useful life and need to be replaced. One sign that a carbon monoxide alarm should be replaced is a chirping sound that sounds until the unit is powered off. This chirping sound will continue even after new batteries have been installed. Models with the digital readout will show an ERR or E09 or end message in the display. The purpose of Beat the Beep campaign is to alert residents that their carbon monoxide alarms may be reaching the end of their life cycles and should be replaced before the beeps indicate the end of the life of the detector. This public safety message brought to you by the Massachusetts Department of Fire Services, your local fire department, and your friends at WMFO.
And welcome back to an Unbalanced Breakfast here on WMFO 91.5 FM in Medford, also streaming live on WMFO.org. Mm-hmm. I have a story about fire detectors, but I'll tell it off air. Very, very traumatic. And then before that, you heard Suicide Machines with Goodbye For Now off their self-titled album, which is my pick of the week. And now we have our second caller of the morning and yet another award winner that we've had on our show. So I'm going to throw it over to Catherine now to introduce her.
Yes, award-winning Emily Finan. So Emily is a registered dietitian. You might know her. She is also active on Twitter like me at Emily Y. Finn. And she's an RD, and she also was in the BMN program, which is biochemical and molecular nutrition. And so she also did a bunch of research on vitamin K, for which she won an award. So we'll be talking a little bit about that. But yeah, Emily, anything else you want to add?
No, that sounds good. Okay. Oh, and I also specialize in nutrition communication.
Oh, right.
So over in the other side, too, a little bit.
Okay, yeah. So she specializes in communication. So she can tell us all about that side of the Freedom
School. Yeah, I'm interested, though, because that was my specialization in AFE. So it would be interesting to hear from a science side.
Did you guys both take the same kind of sequence, too?
I don't know. We'll find out.
Okay, great.
I don't know, yeah.
So, Emily, what made you... You were already a registered dietitian when you started at the Freedman School, like Julia. What made you want to go to the Freedman School? What made you want to specialize specifically in nutrition biochem? And just sort of, like, what was your experience? If you could answer that in a nutshell. I'm asking you, like, such a job interview question, but...
No. So, my undergrad was in dietetics, and so I had a very strong, like, dietetics background. So in terms of maybe, like, counseling or, like, diet changes, and then in terms of, like, food service management. But in terms of, like, statistics, and then maybe even more of, like, the hard science of nutrition, I felt like was a little bit lacking. Like, I know when I would read a scientific study, the method section, like, you know, could have been in, like, Chinese to me. I couldn't. Yeah. I took, like, one intro to stats course that was, like, this is what probability is. So I felt like coming out of my dietetic internship, and I knew I wanted to get my master's, because kind of in the dietetics field, it's definitely moving towards the master's field. And so I was looking at what skills I was missing, and I wanted to get more into kind of like down and nitty gritty into the science and more of a statistical background as well. So if I wanted to research, I would have some of those skills, and that kind of led me to BMN. Yeah,
that's interesting because I know that I did. So you did dietetics first and I did it at the same time as doing my master's. So it's just been really like interesting to kind of take those dietetics classes, which, as you said, are really based in like they're based in the standard of care. They're based in the way that healthcare works and hospitals work, which is really important and crucial to know, but is not always, you know, you don't always go into the like pathway, biochemical pathways or the reasons why things are a certain way. So it's definitely more fun, I think, personally, to dig around in there.
Or like I took, you know, nutrition biochemistry in undergrad, but it was more of just like learning about the pathways versus at Freedman, it's more how you would study, you know, vitamin A in like this mouse model to learn X. So really more like a research nutrition science focus versus just learning like more of just the basics to know about how nutrients interact. But
Yeah. And it's really interesting that, you know, for dietetics, like, you need to have organic chemistry, you need to have biochemistry, mm-hmm. you need all those things. But then it's almost like once you get through those, a lot of times, like, you know, the nutrient metabolism will be slightly less, no, I don't want to say less rigorous. It's just as rigorous, but it's just slightly less involved. So it's just kind of interesting.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it.
So you also wound up working in the Vitamin K lab where you did research and then won an award. So will you tell everyone about that?
Yeah. And I'll also give a plug too. So because I probably will never go into a lab later on, I was really against, in BMN you have to do like a laboratory practicum, but you can kind of shim your way into different things. So I was really against going into the lab. And then I was convinced by various people to do it. And so I went into the Vitamin K lab, which ended up being definitely my best experience at Friedman. So over the summer with my practicum, I was doing food analysis for a study that was going on, and then also for the USDA as part of the NFDAP program, which is, it's like Nutrient Food Analysis Program, which does all the food analysis that goes on to the USDA Nutrient Database for Standard Reference, which I think anyone in the nutrition field is kind of aware of that database. You can plug in like any food under the sun and you can get every single nutrient profile. So we would do all the vitamin K for them. Mm-hmm. And then that sort of spun. So when I was doing that, we were talking in the lab about that some of the mixed dishes that we were analyzing or that they had analyzed were very high in vitamin K. Mm-hmm. And vitamin K, people pretty much always think about green leafy vegetables like kale and spinach and collard greens and all that kind of stuff, and they don't think about like orange chicken and onion rings being high in vitamin K even though they had a significant amount. So what I did then towards the end of that was I went through like back to 2008 and gathered all of the mixed dishes and restaurant foods they had analyzed and kind of crunched those numbers per serving size, and it was coming out that, you know, a lot of these foods that didn't have any vegetables were moderate in vitamin K. And then that turned into even a bigger project, which I'm still working on now, hopefully finishing up like all of the final data analysis this next week, where we went then into Anna Haynes. Which has definitely been an experience. You did Anna Haynes.
Yeah.
Yeah, because really we knew some of these foods are moderate in vitamin K, but if you don't have the consumption kind of to back that up, you know, how much does that really tell you? So we went to NHANES to see which food groups were contributing to the U.S. adult vitamin K intake. And when you look at the vast majority of adults who have low, you know, vegetable intake, really comes out as one of the top sources of vitamin K. So hopefully that will be wrapped up soon and you can read it in a journal near you.
Yeah, that'll be awesome. And so vitamin K, though, is really medically relevant because why? Why is that like something we need to worry about? Isn't that good? Like everybody's getting enough vitamin K?
Right. So it's like something like 2.4 million Americans are prescribed vitamin K antagonist anticoagulants. So these are medications that work directly by counteracting vitamin K to prevent people's blood from like overclotting, which can lead to stroke and all their kind of nasty stuff. And so those people are across the board always counseled to eat consistent vitamin K. And that usually what comes down to is people who get really nervous about eating like a green salad. And I don't want to discount that those vegetables are extremely high in vitamin K. Like even compared to these mixed dishes, like they're very high. Mm-hmm. But in terms of overall, people's normal diets, because they don't eat those vegetables as often, that's why it's the mixed dishes that kind of come up as well, mm-hmm. Since they're so infrequently eaten. But, you know, no one's ever avoiding, you know, fried onion rings and cheese sticks. They're only avoiding, right, you know, salads.
Yeah, and in theory, you know, anything that's moderate in vitamin K, if you know that it is and you're on, like, warfarin or something, you should be consistent every day. So it helps, it could be very helpful for people to know, like, if I want to have orange chicken, like, you know, I need to be balancing out whatever. You wouldn't eat orange chicken every day, hopefully, but you need to be eating like similar amounts each day, and so you should be taking that into account. Or is it enough vitamin K where people should be taking it into account?
Right. I think it's just being aware of where it is in your diet. So I mean, like I was saying, there's not as much as in like some of these really high green leafy vegetables, because vitamin K, the main form is in a component of chloroplast in these green leafy vegetables. But I think, you know, if you're going to eat some huge fried, so it's really in the oils, it's in these plant oils, so these fried foods with plant oils. So if you're going to sit down and eat some huge fried oily dish, then I think you should be aware that that's a pretty heavy vitamin K load. And that also, when vitamin K is in an oil, because it's a fat soluble vitamin, it's much more bioavailable than when it's in a raw green leafy vegetable. It's a lot harder to get out in that fibrous plant matrix.
Yeah. So it's really cool that you were able to do this kind of really involved research project. And I know a lot of people who do their master's at Friedman, even in FPAN and in BMN and in AFE, they can get onto these really interesting research projects, community-based research or like bench-based research. And so I think that's something where like not everybody does it. Like I didn't, I mean, I did a practicum and I worked in a lab and everything, but I didn't, I wasn't part of like some huge ongoing study, but that's definitely an option for people who are interested. So if you are interested, I keep throwing it out there, like, but if you are interested in coming to school, you can do it where you wind up in a lab and you work on a big project, and it just seems like it's a great learning experience.
Right. And like you mentioned, Emily, you can wind up being published and you may have no idea, right, especially on the policy side, you may go in having no intention to do that. And then suddenly, at some point in 2 years, you work on a research project and it does get published and your name's on it. So,
yeah,
very cool. And
good experience.
So, swinging a little bit back towards the policy side, can you talk a little bit about your NUTCOM specialization and what sequence of courses you took for that?
So, that's nutrition communication. Just
So, another thing too, when I was coming, because definitely when I was being RD and going back to nutrition school, I was like, I don't want to repeat any of the classes I've taken. I want to do new things and looking at skills I didn't have. And I felt like so writing classes in terms of undergrad were pretty much only the ones you had to take, just by, you know, they make out all the undergrads take like one writing class or whatever it's called. And so I felt like my writing skills were a little bit lacking, and I, you know, could do better at just being a more succinct communicator in terms of writing. And I'm just interested in kind of explaining science to others. And that's definitely a difficult thing to do, and not do it in a way people can understand, and not a condescending way, and also making it interesting. So I think that was, and there's not too many of us who did BMN and specialization at NUTCOM, but I think it's a really great marriage to kind of do both, to have that really strong science background, but then be able to translate it and translate it well and correctly. You know, not, because you can't include all the nuance, but you know, still do it in a way that is still conveying what's the important message.
Yeah.
So that's been really great. And I've also taken like even some oral communication classes through that, like a digital one too. So, and it's just been really different from my BMN. So it's not all
right.
Just,
it must be like kind of a nice break. Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, just like any other field, it's such a huge important component that a lot of people don't still lack that skill to be able to communicate.
Right. It's really hard. And I think too, a lot of times with nutrition, I mean, with any type of science, like, you really want to make something as simple as possible so that when you're explaining, here's why we're recommending that you limit your solid fat intake or something. You know, I think we hear people say things like, well, if it's solid when you eat it, it's solid in your arteries. I'm like, oh, that type of thing just makes me like cringe. Like, I see how it's like, but it's such a simplification that actually becomes untrue. So like the idea of like, how do you explain the best, you know, the best science or the best recommendation without oversimplifying it to the point where you're making it sound like magic, basically.
Right. Yeah, it's difficult.
Yep.
So, well, what's your favorite Friedman experience before we let you go?
I think probably definitely would be working in the Vitamin K lab. It's just a really good group over there. And so being, do like also the lab work, being, I was doing, with the food, I was doing it through HKLC, so high performance liquid chromatography. So getting really down into the lab, and that was really fun. And working with people in the lab, and then doing NHANES, even though it's definitely a challenge, I made me a better person. I swear,
Made me a better person. NHANES. Did you do that in SAS or what statistical?
I did it in SAS. Yeah, because all of the dietary tutorials are in SAS.
So they have helped me
a ton. So that's just, I think, definitely my best experience at Friedman. And I think just all the faculty and staff, everyone there is just super great and very approachable. And kind of feels like everyone's your cheerleader there, which is nice.
Yes. And I don't know from experience, but I know that that's not true across the board wherever you go to grad school. So it's definitely something that's characteristic of the Friedman School.
It is a very small school too, so I feel like even if I don't know everyone, I can like recognize people's faces, which is nice. It just definitely feels like a community when you're on the Friedman campus.
Yeah, great. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you guys for having me on.
Yep, thanks for having me, and congratulations. We'll probably see you tomorrow.
Yeah, we'll see you tomorrow.
Yeah, thank you. Can't wait. Bye.
Thanks.
Bye.
So there you go. Got the full range of perspectives.
The full Friedman. Yeah, so it was just interesting. You did a communicate. What was your experience with the communications specialty?
I thought it was great. One of my favorite classes was communications in, I'm going to get the exact name wrong, but in public health communications, public health campaigns. That was a Jean Goldberg class, which is amazing. And it's one of those things, like coming into Friedman, and I know a lot of people feel this way, that group projects are the worst thing in the world. Like, you know, this group project.
Yeah.
I think in general, the fact that it's a grad school and the topic that, I mean, everyone's there for nutrition, so people are going to be a lot more motivated.
Right.
And this class was one of the greatest, best groups I've ever worked with. So it totally gelled. It was an awesome project. And it was a real world application too. Same thing with the food justice course. When Ross and Kathleen were in a few weeks ago, we talked about that, and now we met Ross through the food justice course. So any classes where you have a chance to work with a real life organization and implement a real life project is great.
Yeah, I know I did. So my concentration was in nutrition epidemiology. So in addition to taking the regular biostats, I took, you know, sort of an intermediate, I guess you would say, biostats when I did work with NHANES. And I did not use stats. I actually used R, which is a different statistical program. And there are some tutorials for R on NHANES. So if you are interested in playing around with NHANES, but you don't have SAS because you're on your personal computer, there is some stuff for R. But so I did that. And then and I thought that was really interesting because I know that a lot of our dietary guidelines and the way that we make recommendations for people are based on epidemiological studies. And I think people can oversimplify the usefulness or uselessness of observational studies. So I thought personally that was really interesting, but my initial background was in communications. So I kind of switched and did like science and dietetics. So I know that both Julia and Emily came from science and dietetics and then moved into Emily, like more intense science, and Julia into agriculture. So it was just really neat. Everybody's background is very different. Mm-hmm. I know the other thing too, that we didn't represent in this show is that, you know, both Emily and Julia are RDs, but there are a lot of people who come to the school who are.
I had to take a bio course before the year before I applied because I didn't have any science background.
I had to take all my science classes. But there are chefs. I feel like there are a lot of people who are cooks and chefs, and a lot of people who are teachers. A lot of people who, so it's just all different backgrounds, but everybody who's really passionate about food. So it's just a fun environment to be in.
Yeah, definitely. So, that is a wrap for us. Again, the show will be back in some form or another. Stay tuned for that. Follow us on Facebook, Unbalanced Breakfast Radio. Also, our SoundCloud, where you can download all our shows, SoundCloud/Unbalanced Breakfast. And yes, this is going to sound weird. When the show was conceived back in a bar 3 months ago or whatever, and
I was not there.
Well, no, yeah. It started as a pitch for a different thing. It was a last second pitch at a different place. And then I was at a bar one night with a friend watching. So I just started thinking about like the Sprout and everything like that. So I started texting Kathleen, like, hey, you want to do the show? Like, cause I have had another show here for a year and a half and that wasn't going to work out this semester. So it was like a last second thing. And then like a week and a half later, we were on the air.
Yeah.
And we thought like, oh yeah, maybe we can interview some students, have our friends on or whatever. It would be cool. And then we wind up interviewing Dr. David Katz, Marion Nessel. Mm-hmm. Grant Ritchie from the Prism Podcast.
Alan Levinovitz.
Yep.
You can't see, but Matt is actually sobbing silently. Yeah, definitely. He's just tears are
very emotional
out of
his as
face.
Usual.
Yeah, as usual. He's pro this show.
I am pro this show. It's lasted this long. Do you have any final hot takes before you sign off?
I don't. Congratulations to everyone who's graduating. Congratulations to everyone who's staying for another year. Congratulations to any prospective students or who are accepted, who are coming to the Friedman School. And, you know, that's all I got. That's all I got.
Awesome. Well, thank you. It's been a fun ride. And good luck with your big speech tomorrow. Everyone should go find a way to check it out.
Oh, my gosh. I'm just going to play this like, I'm going to stop and play this radio show for an
just
hour.
Just like your greatest hits from...
Yeah. And then mic drop, even though I haven't spoken.
Perfect. Well, awesome. Yeah. And then one show that isn't going anywhere, Mike on the Mic. Stay tuned for him next. And yeah, we'll see you at some point back on the air. Again, check us out Facebook, SoundCloud, and we will be back. Have a good weekend.
When it comes to me and you,
and him and her and the baby too,
too many cooks, it's true.
You say it goes, it'll spoil the broth.
Honey, I think that's not true.
Well, maybe too many cooks will spoil the broth, but they'll fill our hearts with
so much, so much love. Too many cooks.
A family is like a soup.
Everyone adds an extra scoop.
Mix an ounce of a smile so sweet.
A dash of cool to add the heat. And you've got
too many cooks.